Secondly, I just want to mention a talk that was given at the conference at MIT on emergent systems. So people who heard it there may not want to listen to it again, and apologies for that. What I'm going to talk about is three novel and exploratory ideas about how ideas about quantum gravity might be tested cosmologically. And I want to emphasize that these are exploratory. That is, the idea is to put some ideas out there about novel ways in which theories of quantum gravity might be tested. And therefore, I look forward to stimulating discussion and criticism, and maybe we'll also stimulate some other ideas. I'm going to talk quickly in each case, about 15 or 20 minutes in each case, about three different papers or ideas. The first two are in collaboration with Carlo Cataldi and Zhao Mukwege, and are in two papers that are out. And the last one is in collaboration with Bottini Marcopulo and Chanda Prescott Weinstein, and is in progress. And I'm going to start on the second slide by talking about, giving a kind of introduction, talking about the notion of emergence. So there's a lot of talk in different approaches to quantum gravity about the idea that space-time is emergent. And the theme here is, are any of these ideas, these sound like good ideas, can we sharpen them up and subject them to observational tests? But to do that, we have to separate on the third slide different meanings of emergence of space-time, because there's some confusion if you don't sharpen it up.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Just go ahead, Lee.
Okay. So there's the idea of emergence of a manifold. That's the strongest hypothesis, that the fundamental description of nature is not fields in a manifold, even diffeomorphic invariant fields on a manifold, but something else, whether it's a combinatorial graph, a matrix, et cetera. Second notion is the notion that the manifold may be fixed. We might say we're working on S3 cross R, but the fundamental variables are defined without reference to a classical metric, and the classical metric emerges, and the classical geometry and connection emerges. And that's, of course, the case we work with in loop quantum gravity when we say that the manifold is fixed, but we worry about convergence of the metric at large distances. And the third is also a possibility, that is, in theories like matrix dynamics or pure dynamics of graphs, there is no notion of operators connected with even the quantum geometry, and the quantum geometry as well might be emerging. So this is just to clarify, the first two projects I'll be talking about are testing notions of the emergence of the metric, and the last one is testing notions of the emergence of the manifold. Now, for something to be emergent in an observationally accessible sense means one of two things. One is that there was a phase in the world in which that quantity was not needed to give a physical description, and that implies that there may even have been a phase transition where the thing that is emergent comes to exist. The second thing is that there may be disordering, so that the thing which is emergent, say a magnetic field or a classical fluid, is a good description at some point, but if you look in a little bit more detail, it's disordered. And we'll be looking at possibilities of each of those. Okay, so let me go right into the first project. The first project was with Carlo Cataldi and Zhao Mukwege.
This is slide 5, right?
This is slide 5. It's the title slide, and I'm going right to slide 6. Thank you for reminding me. I'll try to remember to do the slide numbers. And the idea that we explored here with Zhao and Carlo was test hypothesis that had come up in work of Bottini, Thomas Knocke, and other people, that they know geometers geometrogenesis. And this was the idea that if the metric geometry, the classical metric geometry, is emergent, then maybe the phase transition early in the history of the universe from a high temperature phase where the temperature was near the Planck temperature, where the metric description was not a good description, and where below the phase transition, a description in terms of a classical metric was a good description. And they argued that this could happen in loop quantum gravity or something like loop quantum gravity and quantum gravity and matrix models. And the description of the high temperature phase would not have an effective notion of locality, so that, for example, it might be dominated by graphs that were highly interconnected. So that might solve the horizon problem, and we wanted to know, really claim to be having something with an alternative to inflation. After these days, do a lot more than solve the horizon problem. You want to also that you can be competitive with inflation and other approaches and explain scale invariant fluctuations by this microwave background. That was the project we set ourselves. Is there a set of assumptions for these phases and the phase transitions such that you could compute a spectrum of fluctuations that resulted in such that you would get something that was comparable with real observations? Okay. And the following is a set of hypotheses which were shaped by that desire. And we succeeded to the extent that you'll see. So the setting, now I'm on slide 7, what we assume therefore is not emergent. Assume the existence of a manifold, which is a three-dimensional spatial manifold. We assume that it's possible to distinguish regions and boundaries of regions. And we assume, as is the case in loop quantum gravity, that if you can distinguish boundaries of a region, there are operators which measure the area of the region. And there are also operators, quasi-local Hamiltonians, which measure the energy contained within or measurable on the boundary of the region. And those are the only assumptions that I'll be making, as you'll see. Okay. Now, about the general setting. Now I'm on slide 8, and we describe...
Could you go back?
No, because that is evocative. This is just a Hamiltonian in a quantum, in a generic quantum theory of gravity where there's a term, a bulk term proportional to constraints, and a surface term, which is the ADM energy. And it's something which is not quite the ADM energy, but related to the ADM energy in a quasi-local case like this. Sorry about that. Slow me down if I'm going too fast. I don't need to go through the whole talk, but I want the part that I go through to be clear. So let's assume the existence of these two phases. And we're making hypotheses about how to characterize these phases. I'm now on slide 8. So phase 1 is the non-geometric high temperature phase. We assume that it holds when the temperature is of the order of the Planck temperature very early in the history of the universe. We assume that it's a disordered phase from the point of view of metric observables. So what we can observe is observables on the boundaries of regions, and what we have in mind is a picture from loop quantum gravity, although we don't need to assume the whole structure of loop quantum gravity here, where there are degrees of freedom on the boundary. The number of degrees of freedom is proportional to the area, so we see these as the punctures on the surfaces in descriptions of horizons of loop quantum gravity. We assume there are no long-distance correlations between those degrees of freedom, so that at this high temperature, the energy within such a region is proportional to the temperature times the number of degrees of freedom on the surface, which we are, by the first assumption, is proportional to the area. So the key thing is that the energy in each of these regions is assumed in this disordered high-temperature phase to be proportional to the area of the region and the temperature. We assume that there's a mass gas, that is, if you try to excite degrees of freedom on the surfaces, that involves adding degrees, adding units of energy in the order of Planck masses, like a graviton here. That's the basic physics of high temperature phase. Then we assume that there's a phase transition, which I'll be saying something about in a moment, to a low temperature geometric phase, where a description in terms of a classical metric and field moving with respect to the classical metric has become appropriate. This is ordered so that there are long-distance correlations of the field, and in particular, there's no mass gap, no massless degrees of freedom. If you believe that the metric description is emergent and did emerge in some phase transition early in the history of the universe, you would sign on to most of these, but it's going to be crucial for the result is the idea that the energy is proportional to the area. As you'll see, that's the key to everything that follows. Okay.
So something like in a black hole case, right? The energy is proportional to the radius of the horizon, which is square root of the area.
Yes.
And so here it is critical for you that it is really n and not square root of n. Is that right?
Absolutely, as you'll see. Thank you for that. And people who like to throw around the world hold the word holographic, they like this. As you'll see, but we're not going to be making grand proclamations about holography. Okay, on to slide 9. Okay. Here we study thermodynamics in phase 1 of one of these regions. We assume that the observables available are the average energy in the region, the average area of the temperature, and the number of degrees of freedom. We've already said that the area is proportional to the number of degrees of freedom on the boundary in Planck units. And I'm just really restating that there are no correlations, which means that the energy is proportional to the temperature times the number of degrees of freedom. And from there, we compute the specific heat at fixed area, because that's an observable we can get our hands on. And the important thing is the equation in the red box, which says the specific heat is proportional to the average energy. And that, we'll see, is the main thing that we use in the future calculation. That's the thing that we take away from the description of phase 1. Okay. Now, from that, it follows by basic statistical mechanics, and now I'm on slide 10. I think I won't go through the calculation, which is textbook statistical mechanics, but it's there for people if they want, up to the next to the last line, which is the fluctuations in energy being proportional or equal to the temperature squared times the heat. And we put in our result of the heat being proportional to the area, and we have a relation for the fluctuations in area, in energy, in each of these regions in the first high temperature phase, which is given by the equation in the red box, specifically that it's proportional to the area as well. Now, let me just mention, if this was ordinary thermodynamics of a gas, the specific heat, which is proportional to the number of freedom, would be proportional to the volume. And so it's important to point out, and that would not lead to the result that we want. So the whole point is the specific heat being proportional to the area and not the volume in the first phase. Okay, slide 11.
Again, go back, sorry. Sure. This is not over an energy. This has a dimension of energy.
Yes. I'll be dividing it.
Right. You're going to divide it by. That's not canceled out the area? That goes as one of our areas.
Could you repeat the question, Lee?
The question is why I'm not talking about delta rho over rho. And the answer is I will be talking about delta rho over rho when in those two slides.
But Lee, can I ask a question?
Yes, of course, John.
Is your theory pure gravity, or have you got matter as well?
We do not need to distinguish at this stage. Well, let me emphasize the spirit in which this is being done. Somebody comes to us and says, I have a model of the emergence of the classical metric, whether it's a spin flow model, loop quantum gravity, Hamiltonian, quantum gravity, causal dynamical triangulation, sea of Wolfram, whatever. And what we're trying to do is say what you should calculate to be able to have something to compare with observation. So we're trying, I do make reference to loop quantum gravity because that's the framework in which I work and think, but we want to have something which is generic so we can say to somebody, here's what you should calculate if there is a non-geometric...
Non-geometric...
What? We're hearing
the voice.
So if somebody gets a voice, try again because that's why there's an echo. So the message is, as you'll see, okay, compute the specific heat at fixed area in your high temperature phase, and as you'll see in a few slides, if you get the result that that's proportional to the volume, then you are not on the way to an explanation of the cosmic microwave background, and if you get an answer that's proportional to the area, you have a chance to be on your way to an explanation of the cosmic microwave background. Okay, so that's the spirit in which this is offered. Okay, this is, you know, admittedly loose, non-rigorous stuff, and it's meant to be phrased as generically as possible because we would like people, we would like to suggest that people try to do such calculations. I think the control model is the kind of thing that's done in the present state of the control model.
Lee, your voice is fading a little bit.
Okay, I'll stay closer to the microphone. Is that good?
Yeah.
Now, we're going to talk about phase two on slide 11 and the next couple of slides. In phase two, then we assume that after the phase transition is completed, we're looking at a classical Friedman-Robertson-Walker geometry. Again, we're not explaining how that happened, but if that didn't happen, your theory is not a good theory of the early stages of the universe. So this is a project which is open to theories when they can explain how the description of a classical universe emerges and why it is that a cosmological universe is close to Friedman-Robertson-Walker. So we will be discussing things in terms of the standard form of Friedman-Robertson-Walker, which is the equation on slide 11, and trying to compute the power spectrum for the fluctuations inside the gravitational potential. Okay, now, here's what we assume about the phase transition. And there are two aspects of this. One of them is fast, and there will be a parameter to quantify how fast. A second one is that there is a critical temperature where it starts, Tc, which we assume is below the Planck temperature by some amount. That will be related to observations, as you'll see. We'll assume that the phase transition takes place as the system cools, that is, as the universe expands and cools to a lower temperature, and the big paragraph in the middle of the transparency is a key thing. We need to assume, and we'll see why in a few slides, that the transition is inside out, which is to say that if you study the system at low wavelengths, long wavelengths, that long wavelengths look classical before short wavelength, and as the transition proceeds, there is a scale, R of T, which can be taken to be a horizon scale, such that the geometry is classical when probed at shorter wavelengths and quantum when probed at smaller wavelengths, and this scale starts big and shrinks inward as the transition completes. And we just have a phenomenological ansatz on that's the bottom equation with one parameter gamma to describe how that might happen. This is just the simplest phenomenological description. The key things are that there's a critical temperature where it starts, Tc, and the transition is outside in. slide 13. We then match the delta energy where we now consider, let me start again, we now consider a moment when that scale where, which is just becoming classical, R of the temperature is some certain intermediate value. And what we're going to do is match the spectrum of fluctuations for the fluctuations in energy at that scale in phase one with the fluctuations in the energy momentum tensor at that same scale in the description in phase two. And that's what we do on this transparency. So we define a delta rho squared, which is the fluctuations in energy as that is the energy momentum tensor of matter in phase two. And we match that with the fluctuation in energy at the from phase one divided by the appropriate factor of the Vian scale, which now makes sense. It now makes sense to talk about a radius, which is the square root of the area, and a volume, which is the Hertz power of the area. And that match takes place on the bottom line of slide 13, using again our result that the specific heat coming from phase one is proportional to the area. And that in particular gives the dependence on the right-hand side of the last equation that the fluctuation squared expectation value goes like 1 over the area squared. Next slide, slide 14. Okay. We now use the linearized Einstein equation.
Lee, can I interrupt just 1 second? Just at the last transparency at the very end, you were somehow implicitly identifying the scale R with area. Is that what you meant to do, or was it?
Yes, that's what I meant to do.
What is the justification for that? That's an assumption?
So the assumption is that at that moment in the phase transition, we're looking at a scale R which has just become classical, so we can talk about metric fluctuations at that scale, but we also have had a fast transition from phase one, so if we consider many such regions, the amount of energy enclosed is going to be governed by the distribution in fluctuations in energy coming from phase one for regions of that area.
But to define the scale as by saying that that is a scale at which, below which the fluctuations are important and above which they are not important. So a priori, that scale could be quite distinct from the area, the surface of the region, right?
No, it's not the scale at which the fluctuations are important. It's a scale above which the classical description is
exactly
appropriate.
Right.
And therefore, the fluctuations are fluctuations in energy momentum tensor, and below which the classical description is inappropriate, and therefore the fluctuations are just fluctuations in energy content in this non-geometric description.
Okay, but still, that is one scale that you just defined. I mean, I meant to say what you just said. And the other is the area of the surface of the region you are considering. And a priori, there is no reason to identify the two.
But we do.
Okay.
We do. Why don't we come back in the discussion if you'd like to talk about that. I don't know if I want to take everybody's time for me to think sloppily on my feet about why we do, but it's a natural thing to do.
No, I just wanted to know. Okay, it's an assumption. That's great. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. So now we use the linearized Einstein equations, and that's the first line on slide 14, the first equation. We match the power spectrum, and these are standard formulas from cosmology, from standard early universe cosmology. We match the power spectrum in the gravitational potential with the power spectrum in the energy momentum tensor. That's the line that starts power spectrum of phi at a scale k, and together with the result that the specific piece is proportional to the area and not volume, if we just do that at the critical temperature, so that is to say, we assume for the moment that the phase transition happens completely at the critical temperature, then we get the formula in the bottom line, which is scale invariant. That is, the power spectrum is equal, essentially, to the ratio of the critical temperature to the Planck temperature squared. And that is the scale invariant result that begins to be discussable as the cosmic microwave phenomenon. And again, had we had anything else for the scale dependence of the specific heat, we would not have gotten it. Okay, now, slide 15, if we do a little bit more detail in the context of the model that we assumed and have the phase transition happen governed by a parameter gamma, which governs how fast it is, then we get a more complicated formula, which is the formula on slide 15. And we see that there is a small dependence on the scale of the fluctuation. K is now the wavelength of the fluctuation, and there is a small dependence. Now, at this point, Carlo and Zhao made use of a standard method in cosmology, so there are people in this room here who know much more about how one does things like this than me. So if questions come up, I hope you'll be helpful. But what they did is took the data, took this power spectrum, it has parameters which are Tc and gamma, which is the speed of the phase transition, and they compared them, and that's the plot. And the plot is done for two assumptions about the scale where the phase transition completes, L0, and there's not much difference varying those assumptions. That's the difference between the green and the yellow plot. And what the data suggests, therefore, is three things. One of them is that the critical temperature is about 10 to minus 4th of the Planck temperature, which is compatible with a lot of other scenarios. That's a grand unified kind of scale. Second is that the parameter gamma is large. And the third is that if you work out the consequences of this, which I'm not just going to do in this talk, you see more of a running of the spectrum than a tilt of the spectrum.
So it's the perfect hitting button to gamma close to zero.
Yes, I believe, yes. I'm sorry, infinity?
Infinity?
Yes.
Can I ask a question? These are fluctuations. Random thermal fluctuation. There's a lot of difficulty in trying to mimic, trying to model results, as we know.
John, the precise point, which I know that you've worked on a lot, and I know you discussed a lot with Zhao, is that if you have most scenarios where there are thermal fluctuations have difficulty reproducing the observed CMD. And the observation here, and this is also related to an observation made by Robert Brandenburger and collaborators. The observation is your scenario for the high temperature phase has a specific heat proportional to the area rather than the volume, which was the case for standard thermal fluctuation, you have a chance to get a scale invariant power spectrum to come out. If you have standard thermal fluctuations, you have no chance. So that's the message. I want to put this in as generic a context as possible. That's why I've made the assumptions as generic and loosely stated as possible, because this might be applicable. This might be something that one could compute, say, in a SINFO model, but it might be also very applicable to other scenarios.
Do you put it in by hand?
Oh, we absolutely put it in by hand.
So the question is, what's coming out from what?
From your point of view, we put it in by hand. From the point of view of what you know, we put it in by hand.
What are we learning?
The message is something that you know in another context. Okay? The message is, if you have a model where classical geometry emerges, but the context many people in quantum gravity work in, you want to have an addition hypothesis is a position where geometry emerges, and maybe that could be replacing the notion of inflation. You want to have a hope of close reality, you have to get the scale and variance spectrum. And the message is, if you make realize a few simple conditions about your high temperature phase and the phase transition fast.
The audio is very badly, so I think there's some friction or something. So we're not understood very much in the last exchange at all. So there was this remark which said that you have put something in by hand. And what is it that you agreed. So what is it that was put in by hand?
This is a discussion with a cosmologist, John Moffat, who is pointing out that from his point of view, we put the result in by hand. And I'm saying, yes, we put the result in by hand. That is, we found that if you assume basically two things, that in the high temperature phase, the specific heat is proportional to the area, and that the phase transition is specifically fast, you can get a scale invariant distribution of fluctuations, which can be compared to data. And what I'm replying, and I hope it's clear, I'm closer to the microphone now, is that we see this, yes, of course we put it in by hand. Now it's a challenge to people who work with different models of quantum gravity to do a calculation and see whether their theory of quantum gravity reproduces these conditions.
Just one more comment. Everything about the inflationary model is classical, except for the quantum fluctuations, which are sort of 101 quantum field theory. So it's not trying to argue that you have a quantum gravity origin. You can do everything at present, classical level.
John, let me rule out till the discussion section. Neil is here, we may want to talk about cyclic universes and ekpyrasis. There are some inflation people here, you're here. Of course there are alternative scenarios. Okay. The question, again, is if you happen to be working in quantum gravity and you think that quantum geometry was very unclassical, close to what would have been the initial singularity, here's an opportunity for you to try to compare with data. Okay. Of course there are alternatives, and this may be wrong and the alternatives correct, but here's what we in quantum gravity have to do. Okay. We hear some random noise on the system as well, but I'm going to talk closer to the microphone now. So I've really just said most of what's on slide 16 now. So just to repeat, this hypothesis of geometrogenesis can, under certain conditions, reproduce a near-scale invariant distribution of CMB fluctuations. And I've just said what are the requirements. Which are what I've repeated, that the specific heat is proportional to area, that the phase transition is sufficiently fast, and that the transition is outside in. Okay, so we're now leaving this topic.
To understand better the speed issue, so if it's immediate, we said that gamma should be infinite. If it were infinitely slow, gamma would be then close to zero. And so the experiment seems to require compatibility to be gamma equal 100, which you say is fast, but with respect to
I mean, I think that people who work with data can comment better than I can about that. From my point of view, okay, with these hypotheses, we have the possibility of being in the ballpark. Okay. More precise data, for example, enough to distinguish a running from just a flat tilt, could rule this out, I'm told, but I don't think I should, you know, I think that that's something that experts should be discussing. Yes, Sam?
How do you solve the horizon problem here? Because the basically don't have any geometry.
Yes, yeah. And that was the original hypothesis in the work that was inspired us. So that's not dealt with here.
There is no horizon.
There is no horizon in phase
one. Except that there is a
In phase one.
That's right.
The idea is that phase one thermalizes entirely because everybody.
So you do have that.
Yes.
But the problem is that your horizon thinking
during the transition.
With
star cross infinity comes in as transition. Transition stops. You have a classical geometry, and then it begins evolving as a Robert's form.
But there's a finite period where the horizon is shrinking, and you. To this matching during that finite.
Absolutely.
Yes. So there is the same objection actually that I made to Robert Vandermeer. You're assuming that your horizon is not following general relativity because in general relativity your horizon is always expanding and then never shrinking. But you use the perturbation stuff in the same time from general relativity. So your background doesn't follow general relativity.
During the phase transition, the Einstein equations are not being imposed. Okay, are not being imposed. Okay, yeah. So let me be precise, and we have maybe this is something we can discuss at length in the discussion section. This is for people who are not cosmologists. This is a key point on which this and related work has been criticized. I think I understand the criticisms, and it's okay, but it's a touchy thing. The issue is that the Einstein equations. At a time when the critical scale is R, the Einstein equations are holding just outside of R and are not holding inside of R. And the phase transition, this is part of the phase transition happening quickly, so that while the phase transition is happening, the geometry which is being like revealed by the transition doesn't evolve very much. And I prefer to come back and discuss this in the discussion. Okay. Any other comments? And we'll go on to the second. The second is quicker and is a nice little interlude. And actually, it's related. Starts infinite, so it's breaking it.
We couldn't hear the question, sorry.
Yeah, if you Lee repeats the question.
Yes, the question is how big is the transition, is the horizon at the transition? If you look at slide 15, we considered two different possibilities. One that, and they're not that different, one is that the transition stops essentially at 10 to the 11, the inverse of 10 to the 11 GeV, the other that is stopped at 10 to the 15 GeV, which is also where it starts. That is so quick that there's no distinction, there's no difference between where it starts and where it stops. And those are the red and the green contours there. Okay. So the second work is...
So slide 17 then.
Slide 17 is actually related... quite a bit to the last seminar in this series about the Amirti parameter, and it comes out of wondering, it comes out of two things, and it's with the same authors. One is, you know, the Amirti parameter indicates a parity breaking at the level of the gravitational action. My God, you know, mustn't that have somewhere some dramatic effects? In the action, it looks dramatic. And as we all know, those of us who have, who work with the Amirti parameter, magically the parity breaking gets removed by the time you get to the classical dynamics. And then a comment coming from the cosmologists in the collaboration that if somehow there were parity, strong parity breaking effects in gravitational dynamics, this is something that could be seen in by measurements made by Planck. So there's a combination, this comes from a conversation between me in quantum gravity and other people and cosmologists. Okay, but let me introduce it on slide 18 by raising a couple of issues. One is, you know, if we're interested in unification, there is this very interesting issue with respect to parity, which is that the weak interactions are parity asymmetric, of course. Most unification models preserve this up to the unification scale, and certainly string theories, most string models preserve this up to the string scale. And then gravity is parity even, so any theory of unification should ask, where does parity breaking come in? Where does, between the, that is, does it end up with gravity breaking parity, or does it end up with parity being broken somewhere in a transition below the unification scale between gravity and matter? Two things related to this. One is the bottom paragraph, which is that, in fact, there is an issue even for the standard model in making a non-perturbative description of the standard model, which is completely non-perturbative because of the issue of representing chiral fermions with a non-perturbative regularization like a lattice. And there is a lot of work on this, but it's an interesting issue. It's hard to do it, and therefore one wonders whether gravity might play a role. And for example, this is something that string models do well. And there's another issue which is not, I didn't write down here, but for those of us in loop quantum gravity, I think that there's been a long overlooked issue of exactly how or whether we have consistent couplings of the Hamiltonian constraint to gauge theories plus chiral fermions that would have a chiral anomaly perturbatively. And I think that that's an issue that they're very concerned about, but I don't think satisfactory job. So I wanted to focus on this issue of parity as a possible window into early universe dynamics. Okay, now, this is not an entirely new subject. I'm now on slide 19. For example, at higher order, people, for example, Mark Kiminkowski and collaborators years ago, which, if phi were a constant, would be a topological term, but if phi were some matter field, say an axion field, which could evolve, would give parity odd dynamical corrections to the propagation of gravitons and gravitational waves when the axion field phi was evolving. And they considered the possibility that this would lead to effects that would be detectable by observation, but they're higher order effects because, in it, and there is within it a term with, I think, one derivative of time and three derivatives of space. So that's hard to see in the CMB. So we wondered, you know, what if there was some theory of gravity in the early universe that broke parity at leading order so that it would be as if there were separate Newton's constants for left and right circularly polarized gravitons? What if there were such a theory? Okay, and now I'm going to proceed into what would be required to write such a theory. And the second question is, if there were such a circumstance, how would it be observed? Okay, so now slide 20. People will remember discussing that equation on slide 20 from the last talk, those of you who were here at the last talk in this series. And this is the fact that I mentioned that nothing is easier than breaking parity in the action of gravitational theories. And that's one way to do it. That's the Holst action. And the second term proportional to gamma, which is now the famous Amerzi parameter, is parity odd. And that helps us in important ways in quantization. But as many of us know, when you get down to the Einstein equations, the gamma drops out, and you get the Einstein equations no matter what the value of gamma is. And that's the last line. That's the Einstein equation got from varying that Holst action. So there seems to be a mechanism of protection, not only general relativity, parity, and invariant, but it seems to protect itself from breaking parity. And what we did to make that statement I just made precise is show the following. That if you make the four assumptions that I list there, then you can...
Slide 21, right?
Thank you, Jorge. If you start with slide 21 and make the four assumptions listed there, then the linearized equation are parity even. The four assumptions all hold in the early universe. You should not expect to see effects like the ones just mentioned. So those are that the gravitational action is a function just of the frame fields and the Lorentz connection and matter fields and their first derivative. That the action is diffeomorphism invariant and that it's local Lorentz invariant. So what that means, which is an interesting observational test here, is that supposing nonetheless in the very early universe, evidence for a different Newton constant coupling to lepton gravitons was found, then it would mean that one or more of these assumptions is false at the time scale when the gravitational waves were being created. And so therefore, we have a probe of these four assumptions coming from cosmological observation. That is, we know that these four assumptions are good now, but the question is, to what extent can we test them in the very early universe, you know, at sort of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 Planck length? Okay. So, what I just said on slide 22, on the first paragraph, and then the good news, which I'll discuss in the next couple of slides, is that if there were such effects, which are ruled out by those assumptions, they are eminently observable. In fact, I'm told that a paper may be appearing soon putting limits already on from polarization measurements. And what it involves is looking for parity odd effects, interference between the tensor modes, which are represent gravitational waves, and the temperature spectrum in CMB. Okay, and this again is work that my collaborators are more expert on than me. I'm now going to slide 23. And so here to test these ideas, what we did is assume a standard inflation model. So, you know, we're becoming very conservative. And the power spectrum, there's a standard calculation where one computes the power spectrum for modes, different kinds of modes in inflation coming from quantum fluctuations. And the power spectrum for tensor modes has a factor of Newton's constant in it. So if there's separate left-handed and right-handed Newton's constant, then there would be different amplitudes for the left and right gravitational waves produced by quantum fluctuation inflation. Okay, and that's the equation in the center of slide 23.
So how about
the scalar modes? We don't see any way to change the scalar modes with this. Scalar modes certainly do not depend on Newton. Well, but that's an amplitude for that.
That's true?
I believe it's true. I believe that the factor that one expects the tensor mode to be down from the scalar mode is due to that. There are experts here, so you may correct me.
So,
that's
So, but you're assuming that the average energy, or?
Yes.
The chirality of Leschwei handedness is intimately related to fermions, not to bosons. The graviton
yes.
is a boson.
Yes, no.
Why do you expect the chirality? Somehow the graviton was a spinner. It has to do with Dirac and Mirana spinners.
Yes, so there certainly are effects coming from the Imerti parameter related to fermions, and a number of papers have been written about that. But nonetheless, there can be odd parity, as I've been discussing, there can be odd parity effects related to gravity, and I think I've defined how they would be observed. But let me go on. I'm almost at the end of this. So then Carlo and Dow did a standard calculation that, again, experts will understand, and that resulted in the graph. The graph is the amplitude against the L of the mode, and the important thing is the black line, which is the temperature B mode correlation. And that the claim is that is at a scale where Planck could see it, that's the news. The news is that Planck could make a detection which would have an interpretation as being a parity odd effect of medium order in the production of the tensor modes, and therefore Planck. What among the many things that Planck will be doing? Planck is testing the validity of those four assumptions at the time that the tensor modes are created, assuming that we're in the standard inflationary scenario. And to put it more broadly, I raise the question of, where does the transition from parity odd matter interacting with parity even gravity happen? And might it be that as a result, there are, at the unification scale, parity-odd gravitational effects? And the claim is that to the extent that inflation happens at the unification scale, Planck is probing that question. So we're not coming down saying we have a theory of odd parity gravity and we will jump up and down and be happy if Planck sees this. We're saying Planck could see this, and if Planck does see this, then it will be testing some basic assumptions about the nature of gravity and general relativity at the scale of inflation. Yes?
This really distinguishes from the bleeding effect, like, for instance, if the inflation is coupled to, like, has an action psi coupling, this is what happens with price violation, and you have the telescope from the power spectrum gravitational waves. So is there a way of distinguishing that from
I'm not expert. I'm sure you're an expert. My impression is you'd have to look at the mode dependence. But I'm not expert.
Lee, can I ask you a question?
Wait a minute. Neil has a question here.
Okay.
What you're doing is saying that the left-handed and right-handed gravitational waves
make
different
equations. Yes, linearized. Yes.
Well, actually, it's not so much they have different equations, but they're normalized kinetic sense. They have a different H bar.
Yes.
So I guess you're saying that this would only appear in quantum effect, because classically, H bar. So, when we look today at the reduction of gravitational.
Could you repeat the question, please?
So the question that Neil is asking is he's saying that the mechanism we're talking about here is a quantum effect because the production of modes in inflation is through quantum fluctuations. While I talked about having separately a left and right-handed Newton's constant, equivalently, we could have said there's a left and right-handed Planck's constant. And this does not imply that say in binary pulsars or supernova one would expect to see parity odd production of gravitational waves. And I think that that's true to the extent that we believe that those four assumptions hold on a macroscopic scale for real. We have lots of tests of general relativity on a macroscopic scale. So we're not proposing that.
Okay, so then the question is, where did you get the Lagrangian for the gravitational wave?
No, let me be, I haven't shown one.
Right.
I haven't shown one, and yes, and and part of this research project, which was largely my part, which is not being reported, is all the attempts to make a Lagrangian which would have parity odd effects in, you know, in coupling to gravity. And again, just for the Conoscenti, yeah, so my part of this, which is not being reported, is I played with the Plobansky action, I played with the extended Plobansky action, I played with some things like that, the Kaplan-Via Del Jacobson stuff. And I thought there must be a way to turn the Emerzi parameter into something dynamic that would give a leading order difference from the classical Einstein equation, and I kept failing. And so therefore I turned it around and said, maybe there's a result that I can demonstrate, which is the result on the previous slide, which is why I keep failing. Okay, wait a minute, John, Abhay had a question. Abhay, is it still there?
Yeah, so it is in the same spirit as Neil's question, really. So, but let's just look at the slide 23. I'm just trying to understand the sentence there. So you say, assume a standard inflationary model. So as I guess was implied, that this model is really standard general relativity. And then you calculate the power spectrum of tensor modes. And of course, if I use standard general relativity, then of course I get GN and GL, the left and right Newton's constant, to be exactly the same. So as I understand it, the calculation is the following, that you actually do the calculation in standard general relativity, and at some stage, you come to some equation, at which stage you just by hand say that the right and the left Newton's constant are different from each other, and then proceed.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
that's precisely right.
Right. So this is even, more exploratory than even trying to find an action or anything like that, because what really is doing something in the in-between, at the middle stage, right? To arrive at a particular formula, you actually had to use Einstein's equation because you're using standard inflationary model and you're using all the standard machinery associated with Einstein's equations. And then it's not that from the beginning there is any even a possibility of having something slightly different. And then suddenly in the middle, one parachutes this in. So it's not even clear to me that this really is a quantum effect or anything. It's much more exploratory than what even Neil was saying, I think.
I think that's a correct characterization of it. If you like, this is a challenge to both sides. So we saw this one as a challenge to people thinking about gravity, to see if there's a way of coming up with any gravity theory that could have this effect. And the second thing is to make sure that the Planck people and other polarization CMB experiments look to put limits on this. Just because there's good reason to think it's impossible doesn't mean that it shouldn't be put limits on it. And so, and again, here the experts here maybe can comment. I think that Carlo was, at least at one point, Carlo talked to people on the experiment, and there was a worry that this observable being zero would be used to calibrate other measurements. And we wanted to say to them, before you use the vanishing of this effect to calibrate your other measurements, you should make sure that this effect isn't there, because it is testing some pretty fundamental assumptions about the nature of gravity at that scale.
I just want to make another comment. Going back to the standard model, for a massless particle, chirality is conserved. by Lorentz and Higgins. For a massive particle, it is not. So this is why the neutrino, a massless neutrino, only has one-handed, left-handed. So in order to get left and right-handed, it seems to me you have to make the graviton massive. That leads to all sorts of problems.
No, there's a, what we mean simply left circular polarization and right circular polarization.
Yeah, but it,
just like a, you know, there could be, you know, analogous effects have been looked for in the electromagnetic field. You can imagine that the electromagnetic field Hamiltonian has a term derivative dot E cross B in it, and it gives a parity odd effect which rotates planes of polarization differentially with energy, and that's an effect that for example Jorge knows about very well because it disproved a paper that he and Rodolfo wrote. So certainly parity odd effects in propagation of massless particles, massless fields, have been looked for. And you know, I think that we're fine on that. Now, let me just ask Jorge for guidance. So not surprisingly, we're at two-thirds of the talk, but my guess is, Jorge, that should leave the last third for later and just close this. So let me go to slide 24 and conclude this and have discussion about it. Jorge, is that right?
Yeah, or we could go 10 minutes more if you want and then take questions. We have the bridge until the half hour.
I can highlight the basic idea in 10 minutes.
How about the following? I mean, maybe we should have discussion on that part. Because I think there are many questions that people are not asked and they may want to ask, the first two parts. And once the discussion is over, if there is still time, we should go to the last part. How about that?
I'm perfectly happy with that.
Okay.
Okay, so just to conclude this part, so the idea that the metric geometry is not fundamental and at somewhere around the grand unification scale emerges is testable through two windows. One is, and they're both very ambitious ideas which are exploratory. The first is an alternative to inflation, which might be a phase transition from a non-geometric phase of a quantum theory of gravity to a geometric phase. And we argued that you can immediately rule out such a scenario. For example, if you do a simulation or a calculation in your high temperature phase, say of your spin foam model, and you consider the heat at constant area, fixing some boundary conditions. And I'm looking at Jimmy as I say this, but there are, you know, so many other spin foam people are here. And if you do a calculation, which I'm told the technology is becoming available to do as the spin foam models are cleaned up, and you found that specific heat at fixed area at high temperature is not proportional to area, then you're not going to succeed in explaining the spectrum of microwave fluctuations. What you need is precisely the conditions that we discovered. And the second one is that if, contrary to those four assumptions which underlie general relativity, there is parity breaking in the production of quantum fluctuations of gravitons in the inflationary universe, then this would be, or for any other means, then this is something that Planck and other observatories of CMB polarization can detect at appropriate levels. And therefore, it's something which could be should be a focus of observation, and should be interesting for us to think about. Let me stop there for the moment. And Jorge, are you chairing as far as taking questions?
Okay. Yeah. So questions.
This is Carlo. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, also I have no voice, so I hope I'm audible. I have a very, very simple question about the beginning, the very beginning. Just to clarify, and I think I could articulate the question better if I had more time, but I don't have it. So when you say the hypothesis is that metric is not fundamental and there's a state in which there's no geometry, what exactly do you mean? Are you including in this the simple fact that there are quantum fluctuations in the metric? So let me formulate this precisely. Would you say in the same thing that QED has a phase where the electromagnetic field, there's no electromagnetic field? Wait, is this simple quantum phenomena included in this? Are you there? Hello? Hello?
Hello, Lee.
Carlo, we can't understand you. Maybe you could speak closer to the microphone.
Okay. Can you hear? Can you hear me now?
So, Lee, are you on the line?
No.
Okay. Can I repeat the question, or did I?
So, yes, I my understanding of your question is, what do I mean precisely by the geometry being emergent?
Yes. I mean, would you say that the electromagnetic field is emergent from QED?
Would I say that the thermodynamics is emergent?
No. Would you say that the electromagnetic field is emergent from QED?
That classical electrodynamics is emergent from quantum field theory. Yes, the classical electromagnetic field being in a coherent state so that it can be described by classical Maxwell equations is emergent from QED, yes.
So your notion of emergence includes this simple quantum to classical transition. Is that right?
Yes, although I think that I'm not committed. Look, I don't think I need to be committed to a precise notion of emergence. I think that...
No, that's fine, but I want to know where it includes that, or you necessarily want...
I feel there's a trick question coming, whether I say yes or no. So why should...
No, I just stop here. I just want to understand what
you're... Look, you know, what my point of view here is, you know, I like it when people say, you know, in loop quantum gravity and spin foam models or quantum gravity models, you know, the classical geometry is emergent from a more fundamental description. But if we really believe that, then we should look for opportunities to get something observational out of it. And that's the spirit of this. If you like, this is in the same spirit as, you know, in QED, looking for mesoscopic effects, or in standard quantum mechanics, for something between classical and quantum effects.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So the answer is yes. I mean, your assumption, your hypothesis includes, not limited, but includes the possibility that this non-geometrical phase is simply a quantum fluctuation of the metric.
I went on to specify a precise, well, I wouldn't say a precise scenario, I went on to specify, to characterize a scenario in which it has more teeth. In particular, in phase one of this scenario, the fact that the specific heat is not proportional to the volume, but is proportional to the area, is giving teeth to the scenario.
Sure.
And what I want to highlight is that that simple idea is enough to start making it, that simple idea plus two more equally simple ideas is enough to start making a scenario where you generate things that are comparable to observations. And I think that is a good thing. And you know, people, there's a lot of talk and philosophy, if you will. Let's just say a lot of talk about holography and in different contexts. So here's a characterization of what holography could mean that has within a certain scenario observational consequences. And therefore, you know, I'd really like to encourage you and, you know, other people working on spin foam models to think, you know, there has been a bunch of numerical work with spin foam models. Why not consider, you know, the topology of S3 cross S1, put the system at finite temperature, heat it up, and compute the specific heat and see what the specific heat depends on.
Yeah, thanks.
This is Abha, and I have a continuation of the comment that you just made, Neil, Lee. This is on slide 13, 1-3.
Okay, I'll go back to it. Yes.
Okay, so this is matching the fluctuations in the two phases. Now, if I read this slide, and if I had not read the previous things that you just said, right, then I would think that this R has a meaning that you spelled out in this slide. And it really is that it's kind of a macroscopic scale such that above that scale, classical geometry makes sense. And below that scale, you have to really look at the quantum fluctuations or what you might call the phase one. And then really area of that volume, so to say, has almost no room to play. I mean, there's no role for it to play here. What really is important is just the scale R. And it seems to me that if one now just makes the assumption that for some reason the specific heat really is proportional to R squared, this R squared, it's not really area of any region or anything like that, it's really this R squared, then all your calculations just go through and there is no problem at all. And if you want to say that it has something to do with the area, then you have to justify a little bit more as to why this scale has anything to do with the area at all. So apart from the prejudice about, you know, that in loop quantum gravity, we sort of like this area to be quantized, etc. But for the thermodynamic argument you presented, it seems to me that, you know, with a little bit of thought, I could make an argument, which is at least at the same level, which would say that if, in fact, I take the scale R as you defined it and make the assumption that the specific heat goes like R squared, then I get to the bottom, the equation which is at the bottom of your slide.
I thank you. I think that's fair, and the work that I mentioned by Robert Brandenburger, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of his collaborators, I think could be characterized that way. That is, they had, and maybe somebody here knows, that they had a very different scenario with words like brain gas and string gas attached to it. And when they got to this critical stage, they had a specific heat proportional to R squared, and they therefore got a scale invariant distribution of fluctuation. So I think that's right, and even an example of what you're talking about has been given.
Okay, so I think that maybe, you know, people here working on quantum cosmology or people doing spin foam should really just look at this, right? I mean, there's no reason to really look at the area of the boundary of the region that one is considering.
Yeah, but let me, I think that's fine, but let me emphasize just something, which is that what's happening operationally is that one does this at every scale. That is, the talk about the phase transition sweeps through the scales. If you don't have to talk about the phase transition, you just have to say at every scale R, you apply the equation on the bottom line. And if you have another scenario that leads to that, then that my understanding is that's equivalent as far as the output is concerned, with the exception that gets you to, if we just jump to the next slide, that gets you what we just said gets you to the bottom of the next slide in the red box, the expression for the scale invariant power spectrum. But the observations are beyond this. So this is not good enough. That is, the observations measure a definite either tilt or running in the power spectrum. Niyash, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I think that...
There's
a
two sigma evidence for a tilt. That's not exactly.
Okay, so Niyash is saying there's a two sigma evidence for a tilt, and therefore the scenario that there's a rapid phase transition, and maybe that could be replaced by something else, but I wouldn't try to think it through on my feet, gets you to the equation on slide 15, which gives you something which deviates slightly from scale invariance. And that's what one has to do to be compatible with the observations at least up to two sigma. My impression is that there maybe are a few holdouts who are just saying, well, in the end, the two sigma will go away and it will just be a scale invariant spectrum. But my understanding is also that Planck and other observations will make that, will clean this up and make a definite decision about whether there is a tilt or a running over the next several years. John, before you go, let's have questions from the bridge because they have to disconnect in a couple of minutes. Is the bridge there?
Yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, I really had a small comment which was related to what John was saying, John Moffat was saying, I think. John was saying that, well, for this is about the second part of the talk now, that in order to have something like the parity violation, distinction between left and right-handed modes, that is something that one would see in the fermionic sector and not generally in the bosonic sector. So if we actually have this Barbero-Emerzi parameter of the field, and if we have fermions, and of course they're all coupled to gravity, then there can be an effect on the fermionic sector, which then via coupling to gravity sort of descends to gravitational sector. But that effect would be much smaller than the one that Lee wants. Lee, if you disagree, please say
yes,
that.
Yes, I do agree.
Okay. And so there is an effect, but that's not what Lee is really referring to here. But I really have a conceptual slight confusion about your viewpoint on this, on the second part, Lee. Namely, that you had this no-go theorem coming from general relativity and with certain assumptions, the four assumptions on slide 21 that you wrote down, which will tell you that under those conditions, in fact, GL will be equal to GR. But if you had some quantum theory, then to talk about inflation or something, you will really have to use an effective theory which descends from this quantum theory. So I think you are saying it's not so much that the fundamental quantum theory violates this assumption, but even the effective theory would violate this assumption.
Yes.
That's what you're saying, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm done. Thank you.
More questions?
I don't know if that's good or bad.
Okay, perhaps we can take the question from John then.
Where can I point specifically to some experiment, cosmological observation, and, in this whole scenario where I can say, jump up and say, ah, yes, now I'm seeing quantum gravity, as opposed to the mainly classical description of cosmology that we have presently. A specific smoking gun that says, ah, yes, now I'm seeing quantum gravity, definitely.
Let me try two versions of an answer to that. That's a very important question, and I think that it's a serious one. Something that some people say, and I don't know what I think of this myself, but just to report, is that if the tension modes of inflation are seen at the level which is predicted in standard single field slow roll inflation, then that is a quantum gravitational effect to the extent that that is a detection of an effect which is due to a quantum fluctuation of the gravitational field. That is, if there were not some approximate description where there was a Fock space of linearized spin 2 particles which had vacuum fluctuations, one would not see the tensor mode. So some people claim that an observation of the tensor mode. Now, of course, as always, these things come packaged with other assumptions, but if you have otherwise verification of the assumptions in standard single field slow roll inflation, then the expectation of seeing tensor modes is down by some factor of the ratio of the Planck scale to the inflation scale is a prediction which has an H bar and a G both in it, and that's not full quantum gravity. But look, I don't know if inflation is the correct description or the correct explanation for the very early universe, but I find that an interesting argument, an important argument. The second thing is what the first is aimed at. The first part is aimed at as saying, look, if you believe in quantum gravity, then near singularities, there should be a physical regime which departs strongly from classical general relativity, within which the classical metric should not be a sharp observable. And can one draw predictions from that? So at the moment, I would say that the first part of the talk is a first step to that. That is, it's taking a phenomenon which is observed and seeing if there's an alternative explanation for that phenomenon coming from the hypothesis that there is an early phase in the history of the universe in which one would need quantum gravity necessarily to describe it. And it's exploratory, and it's early. But that's the direction. And, of course, for that to succeed, one has to go a few more steps of the argument and see where predictions of the different early universe hypotheses diverge from each other and where this scenario would diverge from inflation, from variable speed of light, from ekpyrosis, and so forth. And one would also want to know not just that a particular model had predictions which diverged from standard inflation, but that those deviations were robustly connected with quantum gravity. And the direction in which, you know, our further work in that direction has gone on, which was not in the paper, is looking at tensor modes. So the second project evolved out of the first project, looking at tensor modes. And secondly, the fact that you get a logarithmic running, you get a scale invariant spectrum with a logarithmic running of the parameter in the spectrum, as opposed to a tilt, is something which is not, the difference between those two things is not detectable now on present data, but it may be distinguishable by Planck, and therefore that's an area to explore. But let me emphasize again, this is very, these are initial steps, and they're exploratory. The third, since I'm not going to get to explain it, the third hopefully will be coming out in a paper. This has been work on which there's been slow progress, but I think we're getting close to a paper in which one attempts to use disordering of locality, which is definitely a quantum gravity effect, which can arise in loop quantum gravity and other models of quantum gravity, as a possible explanation of the dark matter. But let me, again, if that succeeded, it would first have to catch up with other models, and then it would have to deviate from other models on finer details like the precise prediction for the equation of state and its evolution in time.
The problem with present cosmology is that it's very hard to distinguish all these models by specific critical experiments and observations, including inflation. This recent paper by Paul Steinhardt, Boyle, she effectively says that inflation has no predictive power whatever. It just came out. And he has suggestions as to how to ameliorate the situation. This is a very difficult issue, the whole business.
John, I think I see the clock is getting close to the bridge shutting off. So let me say, I agree, you know, the direction of your questioning is if we're working on quantum gravity, we should be trying to come up, however we do it, whether it's through loop quantum cosmology, the things I've discussed, many other things, one has to try to come up with ultimately predictions for key observations that are doable. And I think that we haven't met that standard, but we're approaching it. And what I've tried to do with these projects is collaborate with people in cosmology and take simple ideas that might characterize the quantum gravity theory and try to see how far we can push them in the direction of testing them with cosmological data. And it's very early. It's hard. You know, it's hard to get this stuff right, but you're pushing us to do this is the right attitude, I think.
Okay, so let's thank Lee again.